Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you from the English service of The Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington, D.C.
The Prime Minister can be removed if, in case of loss of life, or he can be removed if he resigns, or he can vacate his position if he has a vote of no confidence against him.
Plans by a section of the ruling ABC to remove Lesotho Prime Minister fails. We'll have a reaction.
We also shared with the government that it's important coming up with a debate where people will also give their voice and their input before they make the decision. So as a commission, what we're saying, as far as human rights are concerned.
The Malawi Human Rights Commission says it opposes a new government plan that will make vaccination compulsory for frontline workers beginning in January.
We are very much disgusted, disappointed, and it's something that we were expecting because we know the judiciary in our courts are captured by certain individuals.
And a son of former South African President Jacob Zuma says his father is being illegally persecuted. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. In Lesotho, the Minister for Communications, Science and Technology says plans to remove and replace Prime Minister Moeketsi Majaro ahead of next year's general election has failed. Government spokesperson Tionyana Samrapapa says the administration in Maseru is reassuring citizens that the government will remain in office until elections are held next year. His remarks come after some members of the ruling All Basotho Convention or ABC say the Prime Minister is failing to address a myriad of challenges, including the high crime rate facing the Southern African Kingdom. But the Prime Minister's supporters say only a minority of ABC supporters want him to be replaced less than a year before the elections. They accuse the members of seeking to personally benefit to the country's detriment. They are urging the Prime Minister to continue with his work in spite of the small number of people seeking to remove him from office for what the supporters say are for selfish interests. In part one of this VOA interview, government spokesperson Tionyana Samrapapa tells me a majority of parliamentarians and Basotho maintain confidence in Prime Minister Moeketsi Majaro and his administration.
The Prime Minister can be removed if, in case of loss of life, or he can be removed if he resigns, or he can vacate his position if he has a vote of no confidence against him, and the vote of no confidence succeeds, or he comes from elections and then his party is no longer a leading party to form a government, then finally, if he loses majority support in the National Assembly, I am against the motion which I voiced in the meeting, but however we lost in the election in that the majority said he must be removed and be replaced by a member of parliament who is the former Minister of Agriculture.
When do they plan to remove him and be replaced?
They planned to have done it immediately, which is 2 weeks ago. But unfortunately for them, I indicated that parliament was going to adjourn, and it was adjourned on the 6th of this month.
Does that mean those who were planning to remove him will still plan to remove him when parliament returns from adjournment?
No, they thought that they were going to do it before adjournment. When that decision was made, they were anticipating that by this time we would still have parliament open. But unfortunately, it was the end of its sittings. It normally sits the last week of November or the first or the second week of December. So this time it was the first week of December. And then under normal circumstances, when we come back after the recess, after the adjournment, when we come back, it is a budget speech for the next financial year, and when the budget speech has been tabled, there is no other motion that is being entertained in the National Assembly or our Parliament until we have come up with what is called the Appropriation Act, which is the appropriation of the finances. So most probably this now that it was not done before we closed for Christmas, that it can only be done in April. And in April, we'll be left with only 2 months for Parliament before Parliament is dissolved. So yeah. On that note, I'm saying even if I would have wanted the Prime Minister to step down, the procedures are such that it won't be possible only until April, May next year.
People are worried that there's a possibility the government could fizzle out or crash. What assurance would you give the Basotho that the government will stay on and that there will not be any surprises?
The members of our party who are promoting or who are advancing that idea of bringing down the Prime Minister are a minority. We are now 35 in Parliament as the leading party. We are 35 in a Parliament of 115 members. Our coalition partner has 27 members, and our coalition partner plus ourselves, we are 62 in number. So automatically we are a majority, just those two parties. But however, if you reduce the number by 14, which is the minority that supports the motion to bring down the Prime Minister, even if they can align and agree with the opposition is a minority because they are the present coalition in total, we are 81 in number. So the opposition is 30 something, 30 or 40. Yes, it is 38, I think.
I understand the ABC is trying to woo some other members of Parliament so that they can form a unity government. Some people are suggesting
they have just failed in the party itself, in the ABC parliamentary caucus. They found that they are a minority. Now, our coalition partner, the main partner, who is the DC, the Democratic Congress, who has 27 members, does not even support them. So our number, the 23 of us plus the 27 and these other parties, again in the opposition, one party has just made a press conference today, which was led by which is a splinter party from us, which is split from us in June. Is it May? Yes, in May, June. They have just made a statement today that they can't entertain the issue of bringing down the Prime Minister. They want us to finish off the reforms and then get to the next elections.
Toinyana Sam Rapapa is the Lesotho Minister for Communication, Science and Technology and Government Spokesperson. He spoke with me from the capital, Maseru. The Malawi Human Rights Commission says it is opposed to a new government plan that will make vaccination compulsory for frontline workers beginning in January. According to the Health Minister, Kumbizi Kandondo Chiponda, frontline workers, including health staff and journalists, must be vaccinated as part of a nationwide effort to inoculate about 60% of the population. It comes as health experts say only 3% of the population have so far been vaccinated. This, as official figures show, a surge in daily coronavirus infection rate in the Southern African country. Opposing the government vaccine mandate, the Malawi Human Rights Commission argues the measure violates the rights of citizens. It calls on the government to widely consult all stakeholders before implementing the vaccine mandate. For more reaction to the Malawi government's anticipated vaccine mandate, I reach Kate Kujaliwa, spokesperson for the Human Rights Commission.
As Malawi Human Rights Commission, we release an advisory note to government in September this year, where we were asking government before it crosses that line, it should make wide consultation, but also increase public awareness on the importance of the vaccine, but also to hear what Malawians would prefer, whether we should go the compulsory route or we should keep on the voluntary route. We also shared with the government that it's important coming up with a debate where people will also give their voice and their input before they make the decision. So as a commission, what we're saying, as far as human rights are concerned, would rather we involve the people and then increase public awareness and public education, as opposed to rushing to the implementation of the compulsory vaccine, because there are a lot of misconceptions, misinformation and disinformation among the public, which might backfire, and government wouldn't want to go through that line.
But Kate, some supporters of the government are of the view there has been a campaign over the last 2 years to educate or sensitize people so people are aware of the coronavirus and its variants, and the move, they said, is acceptable. Why are you against this?
80% of the population in Malawi live in rural areas where information is not easily accessible as it might be with those in urban areas. In as much as we commend what government has done so far, we still feel, as a matter of rights, that people have a right to know what is in the vaccine. People have a right to make the decision. So it is the balance that we are requesting, the balance of people enjoying individual rights as well as the right to enjoy collective rights. So while it is important that the people should be vaccinated, we should also look at their right to make that decision. So as a commission right now, our point and position is government should hold on the decision of making this compulsory. Rather, engage the public, bring in public debate, increase public awareness until such a time where people will understand the importance of getting the vaccine. And the commission will indeed meet, reconvene, and come up with a position as regards to the new compulsory decision.
Bakid, talking about 80% of the population living in the rural areas, supporters of the government are of the view that health workers and journalists, people who are educated, just a fragment of the population. So they said you are playing politics with a government directive aimed to stop the spread of the disease in Malawi. How do you respond to that?
For Malawi Human Rights Commission, we are there to promote and protect human rights. That includes the right to make a decision whether or not one gets the vaccine. We understand that this also falls in the right to life for people, and then the government has a right to keep people safe. We are with the government. We understand the need to have the population vaccinated. However, the public at this point, we feel it's important that they make the decision. Bringing in the compulsory a vaccine might not really be the best route. That is why we're encouraging government to further consult widely before implementing this.
Are you therefore saying the government has not consulted widely? Because the minister is saying only healthcare workers, just to try to boost vaccination campaign aim to stem the spike in cases, because only 3% apparently of Malawians have been vaccinated against the coronavirus.
I think by bringing the statistics that only 3% have been vaccinated, you say, that maybe should also tell us something about the level of awareness. In our advisory note that we released in September, one of the things we said is government working through with organizations like the Malawi Human Rights Commission should widely support the consultation as well as holding public debates. As I speak to you now, we have not been able to hold such consultations. So I would say the consultations might have been made, but not thorough as to warrant the implementation of the mandatory vaccine. Now, in response to your question that these are educated people, yes. When we're talking about the decision and the freedom to make this choice. It involves even those that are educated and the frontline staff. So this is a complicated issue, and we must agree and accept that COVID-19 is bringing in, it's a strange phenomenon. We are dealing with it and with things as they come. And now I think it's only proper that as the information keeps changing, government should do more in consulting, especially knowing that most people are not very receptive of the vaccine even as we speak.
So where do you go from here? What's the next best step forward to address these concerns you have in order for the government to also ensure that the population is protected from this disease?
As a commission, our advisory note still stands, and as our door is always open to say, okay, if government is willing to get support to hold this public debate, we are there and we are ready to hold this debate so that government can hear from the people. And then the public awareness should go further, and that they should understand and also hear from the people what they really want to ensure that everyone is safe before we cross that line.
Kate Kujaliwa is the spokesperson for the Malawi Human Rights Commission. She spoke with me from the capital, Lilongwe. A son of former South African President Jacob Zuma says his father is being illegally persecuted. Edward Zuma says supporters of the former president are sharply against a recent High Court ruling that ordered Mr. Zuma to return to prison to serve the remaining 15 months jail term. Mr. Zuma was released on medical parole by Arthur Fraser, a former commissioner for the correctional services. This after the former president expressed concern about his deteriorating health while in prison. But in a ruling on Wednesday, the High Court said it is illegal for the former president to be released on medical parole. Lawyers for the former president as well as the correctional services say they will appeal the ruling. Former President Zuma was sentenced to 15 months in jail for refusing to appear before a commission of inquiry investigating acts of corruption during his presidency. The former president's son, Edward Zuma, tells me that although the ruling was not surprising, he and his father remain hopeful that a different judge will decide in Mr. Zuma's favor.
We are very much disgusted, disappointed, and it's something that we're expecting, because we know the judiciary and our courts are captured by certain individuals.
Do you know those individuals saying they have been captured? Some people might see that as slandering, you know, or defamation.
Well, look, if they think it's defamation, then they must prove to the country and the world by unsealing the CR-17 documents. They favored and they sealed those documents. The question one is asking, why did they seal those documents if they claim to be very objective and they are impartial and they treat everyone with equal treatment before the law? Why then did they decide, as the courts of this country, including the highest court of this country, they decided to seal this document? What is it that they are hiding? It's because those statements which are CR-17, have names of judges that were paid.
The president, your father, and his legal team are saying that they will appeal. Where do you stand?
We agree. It's another legal recourse that obviously has to be taken.
So where do you go from here as a son? Because some people are saying, like the Democratic Alliance says, that it was unfair and illegal for President Zuma to be released from jail in spite of his decision not to cooperate with an investigation that was going on. Others are saying that he's being targeted and he's being persecuted. But as a son, where do you stand?
Well, where I stand is that we'll be mobilizing every South African that is in support of President Zuma to secure that this court decision is not implemented at all costs.
But how will you do that?
Well, like I said, there are many ways of reacting to such. We will mobilize and march against it to air our views that we are disgusted in this thing. So by marching, it's our democratic right to march and to gather so that we air our views to say we are against this, we do not want this to happen.
But Edward, are you not worried that this could turn violent like the first time?
Well, look, it's not something that we support and anticipate. But, you know, when people are angry, they tend to do things that are unbecoming. And once again, I'm saying it's something that is beyond our control. It's something that one cannot stop. But we can also not stop people from saying we are tired of the judiciary abusing President Zuma. We are tired of all this thing of the judiciary. Whenever there is a Zuma case, they have to see to it that they implement the agenda of the West.
Some people are saying, although it's legal for you to protest under this condition of, you know, the coronavirus Omicron variant.
You know, the Omicron virus, COVID-19 virus, it's the last thing on these people's minds right now. They are angry, whether there is Omicron, whether there is COVID-19, whatsoever. It's the last thing on right now on my mind. We cannot be held at ransom of saying we cannot gather, we cannot engage because of Omicron virus. It's a strategy that is being used to manage people that they know that are going to be supporting President Zuma. So we know it's a strategy. So it's something that is what we're not going to think about right now. For now, what we are going to be thinking about is to garner support for President Zuma for such a ruling not to be implemented.
Edward Zuma is son of former South African President Jacob Zuma. He spoke with me from Johannesburg, South Africa. The Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission says key state institutions are steeped in massive corruption. Observers say the finding underscores the challenge inherent in turning around the Zimbabwean economy. For VOA, Ade Gondo has the story from Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
This month, retired Judge Lois Matanda Moyo, the head of Zimbabwe's Anti-Corruption Commission, said several government agencies are riddled with corruption and mismanagement. They include the Zimbabwe National Road Administration, Zimbabwe Republic Police, and the Vehicle Inspection Department. She announced their findings during the recently held International Anti-Corruption Day commemorations in Harare. She explained that the three are among the worst-trending state bodies, with some of the officers making at least US$200 daily from activities normalizing corruption. Observers say, though Matanda Moyo revealed that the three state entities are under surveillance by her agency and other law enforcement bodies, the Anti-Corruption Commission is subject to political interference and therefore powerless to solve the problem. Analysts say, what's really irritating is that it's the gatekeepers who are running corrupt syndicates with impunity. Economic analyst Reggie Shoko says corruption is prevalent in every sector, including the Vehicle Inspection Department.
It's observable. Someone can walk in into VID today, you will not just get a license without dropping something for a clean favor. And actually, this is what we see as a day-to-day life. But we also have to appreciate from an economic point of view that corruption is not only affecting the parastatals, state parastatals or government alone. It affects also us as individuals. It takes attitude and political will and individual will to fight corruption. It's never going to be an easy thing for illicit flows, financial flows to stop. But when you have a country that has an economy around staggering around 4-5 billion and you have about 30-40% of such financial inflows going into corruption tenders or activities, it's worrying.
Tafadzwa Chikumbu is the head of Transparency International's Zimbabwe office. He concurs with the findings of the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission, or ZAC.
And I do agree that public institutions are the major culprits for fueling corruption. The same applies to the police, which the Zimbabwe Anti-Corruption Commission referred to. It's now the norm. It has become a culture that it's either you pay the stipulated fine or you have to pay an amount directly to a police officer or a public officer. What they figured out is that sometimes even the police, they even inflate the figure. So citizens are encouraged to know their fines whenever they are found on the wrong side of the law. They need to know how much they have to pay as fines, because at the end of the day, the government loses a lot of money.
Transparency International of Zimbabwe says ZAC should not focus on petty crime.
But we should also not put a blind eye on grand corruption that happens. We've heard of several reports that speak to grand corruption, non-payment of taxes, and transfer of proceeds of crime to secret jurisdictions and tax havens. You know, the Senate report, the Panama Papers, the Pandora Papers, they figured out some entities which are involved in... Yes, we should build a culture of transparency, integrity within our citizens, but we should also bring to book those that are involved in grand corruption, that which prejudices the state of huge sums of money.
He says that a report by the Reserve Bank of Zimbabwe revealed that the country loses around $3 billion in illicit financial flows. Reverend Ray Motsi of the Theological College of Zimbabwe offers another take on the problem.
And so the corruption is in the mind, the corruption is in the heart, where we begin to think things that are wrong are right. And that is part of the biggest problem. But the other very critical aspect is the whole process and concept of, which in my opinion has been flared by entitlement, impunity, and lawlessness. And these three brothers are the key problems in our country. Unless there is a political will to change things, I don't think this will change. I also personally believe, at the personal level, that I also think that the government right from the top is corrupt, and therefore they can never be able to work on corruption because in themselves they are corrupt.
Observers such as Motsi and Transparency International maintain that Zimbabwe is not lacking in legal and institutional apparatus to pursue corruption. What's lacking, they say, is implementation. Reporting for VOA, this is Adigondo in Bulawayo, Zimbabwe.
In Uganda, medics working as interns say they will continue with their industrial strike action until the government meets their demand. Dr. Lilian Nabwire, president of the Association of Medical Interns, says the government has yet to meet their demand despite repeated promises to increase their salaries. But supporters of the government have dismissed the strike as unhelpful and a threat to the well-being of citizens, especially during the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. They accuse the medical interns of extorting the government and of not being sensitive to the plight of Ugandans. The health ministry has since issued a directive saying the striking medical interns should leave the country's health facilities within a week. But a parliamentary group and trade unions have called on the health ministry not to fire the interns. In Uganda, they are required to complete a year's placement in order to qualify as licensed health workers. They are paid $200 per month. For the latest developments regarding the effort to encourage talks for a negotiated solution to the strikes, I reached Dr. Lilian Nabwire, president of the Association of Medical Interns.
The strike has actually become more popular and more known currently because of the letter we received from the Director General of Health Services of Ministry of Health, instructing hospital directors to evict medical interns or to instruct them to vacate hospital premises because of them striking. The working conditions are not favorable for us to do our work appropriately and serve the Ugandans the right way we should be serving them. So we step up and say, let's follow up on the resolution that Parliament made, what has prevented the implementation. And so as we kept trying following up, and we never got any response from any of the government officials.
Some people are expressing concern that you are blackmailing the government to bow down or to kowtow to your demands. How do you respond to that?
Well, we are not blackmailing government because our government has been making promises to change the situation right from 2017. And like I've given this brief history, we went ahead because the recommendations of Parliament initially were to increase in terms of doctors 33 million. Later in our first strike, we meet the President of the Republic of Uganda. He says, no, government cannot afford 3 million for you in turn, but we can do 2.5. And we still accepted. We understood the position of government. And he gave a directive that this is implemented starting in July. Government itself giving themselves that pledge I mean, they made the promise without being coerced. We later fall up and it's not implemented. And that's why we called for this second strike, to call for implementation of the presidential directive. Can you imagine us being on strike to force the government to implement what the president of the country has directed?
The heads of the National Organization of Trade Unions, NOTU, and the Parliamentary Health Committee have asked the Ministry of Health not to terminate the training of the striking medical interns in the hospitals. What's your reaction to that?
As medical interns, we are extremely happy and glad that there are people that see the value of medical interns in this country, that understand how much critical we are to the health system, and they can actually come out openly and speak about the injustices that are being done to the medical interns. So as the medical interns fraternity, we are very, very, very grateful to the chair of NOTU. We are also very grateful to the workers' MPs that are standing up for the rights of the marginalized interns in this circumstance, in this current state. So we appreciate them, and we call upon many other people to come on board and stand up against this injustice.
Talking about asking people to come on board, some people are saying that this is not the time to go on a strike, particularly when the government faces this pandemic that has negatively impacted the economy, for which it would have raised funds to address some of your concerns, and that it is in bad taste to do this, and you are putting the lives of Ugandans at risk by embarking on this strike during this pandemic. Your response to that?
The medical interns and the health workers as a whole have been the people that have been at the forefront of holding this government together throughout the pandemic. Many health workers have died. We have all seen the statistics. But even despite that, and many of the health workers have gotten infected with COVID, medical interns during the pandemic have been there for the government. At the peak of the pandemic, I mean, yes, the pandemic has not gotten done yet, it's still existing, but right now we are no longer at that peak where people were dying very much, especially in the second phase. Medical interns were called upon in the second phase when many people were dying, the hospitals were overwhelmed, and there was a gap because ministers had employed a few workers and they were not managing the much work. The interns came and stepped in and put their lives online to be able to cover the gap because they are patriotic. If we really wanted Ugandans to suffer, that's the time we would have backed out and said, no, we are going on strike. We want money. If we were people that were money-minded. But we kept patient. We worked so hard. We didn't leave our country or Ugandans to die. And right now, the pandemic has actually gone down. We expect that among government priorities, because that COVID-19 has actually exposed the inefficiencies of the health system of Uganda. Right now, focus should be much on strengthening the health system, equipping it with the requirements, the equipment that we need, the supplies that we need, and also motivating health workers to even work better, because I mean there are many other things that are coming, many other things that may come, many other pandemics may come. The health workers that have stood with the country at the peak of this pandemic, if they are demotivated now, how much room will they have in the future to come to actually stand with the country again and stay patriotic?
Dr. Lilian Nabwere is president of the Association of Medical Interns. She spoke with me from the Ugandan capital, Kampala. The president of the governing board of the ECOWAS Network of Electoral Commission, or ECON, is calling on the heads of electoral commissions in West Africa to demonstrate diligence and professionalism in their work. This, Dr. Mario do Rosario Goncalves says, will help stop concern over the reversal of democracy in West Africa. Dr. Goncalves is also the chairperson of the Cape Verde Electoral Commission. She spoke at a recent conference in the Ghanaian capital, Accra, themed an efficient communication strategy for enhanced relationships between electoral monitoring boards and other stakeholders in West Africa. Goncalves expressed concern that the current situation makes the task of electoral management
government bodies more difficult to restore public confidence and trust in the ability to administer credible, transparent, free and fair elections. In part one of VOA's interview, Dr. Goncalves addresses issues including election disputes in parts of West Africa. Experts say they contribute to what they call a slide towards non-democratic systems of governance in the region, including coups. Speaking with me, she also outlines the role electoral stakeholders such as political parties and civil society groups can play to bolster electoral processes in Africa.
Electoral management bodies are often dragged into most electoral disputes in our regions. And in many cases, there's electoral disputes and up in courts, which then decide the result of elections. For me, this is against the democratic principle, which bestows of the people the right to choose their leaders. Therefore, the need for electoral commission to constantly manage the electoral process and the credibility, impartiality, and transparency is necessary to build and retain the trust and the confidence of the population, political parties, and the candidates. As you know, electoral bodies are sometimes also victims of political pressures and harassment in the exercise of their functions. So we must remain vigilant so that we do not become part of the problems or contribute to weakening our electoral process.
Do you think these election disputes in parts of West Africa contribute to what many say is a slide towards non-democratic system of governance in the region, such as coups?
Yes, it's possible. If we think that, according to the ECOWAS Supplementary Protocol on Democracy and Good Governance, military coup etat or any form of access to power that is not constitutional constitute a setback to democracy. As we remember, all 15 ECOWAS member states have adopted democracy as a form of government. But in spite of this commitment, we have observed some leaders changing or trying to change the national constitution to obtain powers or to remain in powers. And this is not acceptable today for us. So, to ensure peace, stability, and progress of the African peoples, I think that the organizations such as ECOWAS, the African Union, and the international community must take clear and firm measures against unconstitutional and undemocratic measures or conducts wherever they happen. This is the only way to guarantee political peace, stability, and social economic development of our regions, Africa, and the large world.
So what role do you think electoral stakeholders, like the political parties themselves and civil society groups, play to strengthen or bolster electoral processes in West Africa?
Political parties, in addition to providing political leaders, also have the responsibility and duty to create collective civic awareness for political participation. So they can also contribute greatly to the consolidation of democratic values and the principles essential for political stability, such as respect for human rights, respect for the will of the majority, and ensure equal political space for mass citizens' engagement before, during, and after elections. And for civil society, I believe that given their proximity to the population, can also happen in civic education, training, contributing to better knowledge and understanding of the electoral system and process, specialist in digital age of social media. I believe that adequate information and knowledge of what is like in each election by the population, especially the young people and the minority groups, will create political harmony and reduce electoral violence.
Dr. Maria do Rosario Goncalves is president of the governing board of the ECOWAS Network of Electoral Commissions and also the chairperson of the Cape Verde Electoral Commission. She spoke with me from the Ghanaian capital, Accra. In Tunisia, the Speaker of Parliament has rejected President Kais Saied's decision to extend the suspension of the legislature until elections are held in December next year. Rachid Ghannouchi, who condemns what he says has been the president's power grab, adds that extending the suspension will lead to the North African country's isolation on the world stage. He contends that the only way to resolve the political crisis is for the immediate cancellation of exceptional powers recently announced by President Saied. Ghannouchi's remarks come after the president announced this week that he plans to call for a referendum on the constitution in July next year. He also added that legislative elections will be held in December, an announcement the Speaker of Parliament rejects as unacceptable. For the latest political development in Tunisia, I reach Sherif Kadi, a political commentator based in the Tunisian capital, Tunis.
We have two kinds of reactions. The reaction, let's say, of the political elite or political sphere, which is quite divided between the supporters of President Kais Saied and a large number of political parties that are against the power grab of Kais Saied and his decision, and calling mainly for the respect of the constitution, the independence of justice, and also for a national inclusive dialogue. Whereas the supporters of President Kais Saied, they agree with his decisions and they welcome the new timeline or roadmap proposed by the president, and calling for to fight corruption and to fight the corruption, especially in the judiciary system. But when it comes to the population, the main concerns of the Tunisian population or the Tunisian citizens is the economic and social issues, because unfortunately so far, even after July 25th, the economic situation hasn't really changed. In the contrast, it has even, it is seen as being deteriorating. And we are unfortunately expecting, tough months ahead.
Now, Sherif, the Speaker of Parliament believes that the only way out of this political crisis is by the immediate cancellation of exceptional powers that the president announced. Do Tunisians see this as the best way forward to resolve the political crisis?
I don't think that all Tunisians agree on a kind of one solution. But it's what's obvious, and even obvious from the ground, that the popularity of President Kais Saied is still high, despite decrease according to recent polls. The popularity of the president is still quite high, above 60%. And we shouldn't also forget that the parliament is really bad seen here in Tunisia, or was bad seen here in Tunisia by the population, especially during the COVID crisis, when there were deadly oxygen shortages, and we were seeing on national television, watching live on national televisions, MPs fighting with each other and yelling at each other concerning or for other issues than saving Tunisians' lives. So these calls, I don't think that these calls would be, supported by a large part of the population.
The president's action of power grab that the opposition have denounced as a constitutional coup, some say has alienated Tunisia on the international stage. But do Tunisians see it that way?
Well, actually, let's say that the Tunisians are mainly concerned about the economic and social issues. Let's say that the international, aspect of or vision that international stakeholders could have of Tunisians now, at least, comes at, in the second plan or in the background. But what we've noticed is that the roadmap proposed by President Kais Saied at least it's quite obvious that it was done after international but also national pressure from the unions, political parties, elites, etc. So far, we don't see on the ground that people are really afraid of the reaction of the international stakeholders, since their main concern is the economic and social situation. And in addition to that, for example, yesterday and the day before, we've seen an important visit by Algeria President Tebboune in Tunisia, where 27 agreements were signed on many issues and aspects. And also, we've seen the reaction of the spokesperson of the U.S. Department of State welcoming the roadmap announced by President Qais Saied, and at least not criticizing it. So this is could be considered in favor of President Qais Saied so far, or if we could see it this way, there is no strong international opposition to what he's doing right now, at least not obviously.
Sherif Kadi is a Tunisian-based political commentator. He spoke with me from the Tunisian capital, Tunis. Human Rights Watch has petitioned the US and German governments to pressure vaccine makers to transfer technology widely. The group says companies have human rights responsibilities to share with the world their technology and knowledge to help in the fight to limit the spread of COVID-19. This, as a new report says, experts have identified more than 100 companies in Africa, Latin America, and Asia that have both the technical requirement as well as quality standards to produce the mRNA vaccines. It says the list is a clear indication that increased production of the vaccines can be produced outside Europe and the US. The report also suggests that the companies that have produced the medicines are not sharing their knowledge with institutions in the developing world. Achal Prabala is an expert and one of the co-authors of the report. I reached him in Bangalore, India, for more on the report.
We're in a moment where the entire world is being overcome by the Omicron variant, which emerged from a lack of vaccinations around the world. We have a unique opportunity in this moment to expand the number of mRNA vaccines that are being made. We have two excellent mRNA vaccines in play, from BioNTech and Pfizer and from Moderna. Now, all that needs to be done is for these vaccines to be made in much larger quantities so that the entire world can be vaccinated and get the kinds of boosters or reformulations that we're going to need to protect ourselves. But the only way we can do that is if Moderna and BioNTech share the vaccine technology with as many of the 100 companies that we've identified in order that they can be produced everywhere in the world, on the African continent, in Latin America, and in Asia, so that we can vaccinate ourselves, protect ourselves, and eventually you in the United States and Europe.
Well, Achal, there are concerns about patent and copyright issues preventing such from happening. So how can these hurdles be surmounted?
The way that monopolies on vaccines can be surmounted in the short run, in the most effective way possible, is for Moderna and BioNTech, who own these monopolies, and Pfizer to a certain extent, to realize that it's in their interest, it's in the societies that they serve, whose best interest, to create a wider manufacturing base of these vaccines. When you let countries in Africa and Asia and Latin America take care of themselves, they are then also going to be taking care of the rest of the world. There's a moral argument here. It's often, however, not a perfectly sound profit argument for Pfizer and Moderna and BioNTech. And this is where I think the governments of the countries that they're based in, Germany and the United States, come in. They have to be able to see that sometimes what's in the best interest of their societies, the entire world, may not be in the best interest of the companies in terms of their short-term profitability. But yet, that is the solution we need.
Well, I'm sure you know that Human Rights Watch has written to both the US and German government to act. What is the expectations here?
The expectation there that we have and that we're really hoping people can see clearly, especially in this moment when everyone is overwhelmed by Omicron, waiting on edge with nervousness to see what comes, is that we realize we don't have enough ways to protect everyone in the world, and that none of us are safe until everyone is safe. Now, the only way that can really happen, the way that we can put those pretty words to effect, is by keeping everyone safe. mRNA vaccine technology is simply the easiest and fastest technology to make. So if we want to vaccinate the world in the quickest, most effective way possible, there is no better solution than to have mRNA vaccine technology shared with the companies around the world, over 100, who can use it, who can make these vaccines, and create a much better outlook for us in the next 6 months to a year.
Achal, there are suggestions that recent global vaccine production could soon be enough for the entire world.
I can say for sure that there is deep existing vaccine inequity. Less than 2% of Nigeria has been vaccinated. Over 87% of Portugal has been vaccinated. That is the inequity that we have today. Now, unfortunately, it's only going to get worse with Omicron, because what Omicron means is that we have massive expansions in who gets a booster shot in rich countries. And what that in turn means is that vaccination is not an event, it's a process. We are going to be requiring vaccinations on a periodic basis until we see ourselves out of this pandemic. There is no feasible way without a massive expansion, something dramatically changing in the next immediate horizon, in the next couple of months, that we're going to get those kinds of doses of vaccines in the tens of billions next year. It simply doesn't exist. Those numbers of vaccines are simply not being made. When it comes to mRNA vaccines, they are definitely not being made. What we need is to take that dramatic action now in order to fill the inevitable supply shortfalls that are going to occur as a result of increased vaccination demand all over the world.
Achal Prabhbala is an expert and one of the co-authors of the report. He spoke with me from Bangalore, India. You are listening to Nightline Africa on the English service of The Voice of America. I'm your host, Peter Clothier, in Washington, D.C. And coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa, this Saturday music spot from our collection of music from the continent. But first, right now it's time for music from our African collection. I just don't care. Clubbing like I just don't care. If you wanna go, call my number, maybe go together. If you wanna go, I know them are calling, them I know where we are. Mama know thee, Papa know thee. Them are calling, them I know where we are. We are having fun all night. We are chilling, chilling, doing plenty things. Yeah, having fun all night. We are dancing, chilling, doing plenty things. Yeah, if you still at home, I'm so sorry, you don't know what you're missing. Yeah, if you know they're here, I'm so sorry, cause you pay on a long thing. If you wanna go, call my number, maybe go together. If you wanna go, call my number, maybe go together. Mama know, Papa know thee, them are calling, them are know where we are. Mama know thee.
That was music from the continent, and we hope you enjoyed it.
Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC
from the English service of The Voice of America. And from the rest of the Nightline team, Managing Editor William Eagle and producer Tracy Carter, we say a big thank you for joining us tonight. And remember, as the elders say, a tender bamboo cannot be eagerly desired for building. I'm your host, Peter Clotet in Washington. Good evening, Africa.